Right now, I want to say hello to my next guest, Heidi Peterson, naturopathic physician. Hi, Heidi.
Hello.
How you doing, darling?
Great.
I need to say two things first, Heidi. One is that this is an information show, and if people have medical or health-related issues, they should use this only as an information source and speak with their own private provider. We are just here to talk about women's health, women's reproductive health in particular today. And also, in the interest of disclosure, Heidi is a naturopathic physician that I have also visited as my own private health care provider, and so I wanted to make that very clear and put it right out on the table. And Heidi, congratulations. I see you are about to have a baby any day.
Yes.
And that time would be when?
In about 5 weeks, and hopefully at home in the water.
Oh, wonderful. And you already have a little girl, so this will be very exciting for your family.
Very.
Okay, Heidi, you do all kinds of naturopathic work, right?
Correct.
And one of the things that you are very skilled in is women's health. Is that also correct?
Definitely a passion of mine.
Okay, so before we talk about specifics, I wondered if you could help our listeners understand, in your own words, how you compare and contrast, let's say, a visit to an MD and to a naturopath such as yourself for something as simple as reproductive health care.
Well, I think the classic thing that I love is people call regular MD Mick medicine, and particularly I think in managed care, but even not in managed care, it's kind of the assembly line, and they come in and they have their boxes that they tick, and you know, they put you up on the table and do your exam and sort of in and out, and there isn't really much time to be get a thorough history or be very holistic about your care. The other concern I have about conventional gynecological care is the breast exam. And in my opinion, gynecologists are really about the vagina, which is, and the uterus, which is fine. That's what they're trained about. But somehow the annual breast exam is part of that visit, and I feel a lot of them don't take enough interest and time in doing that exam.
Well, what about the breast exam? One of the things that we're encouraged to think about as women is getting the annual mammography. And I know the dates for how old we should be keep changing because we are giving radiation to soft tissue. What are the thoughts about mammography versus the manual, and what kind of manual exam should a woman be looking for?
Well, just to put it out there, you know, the standard recommendations, depending on who you read, is to have a mammogram somewhere, the first one between 35 and 40, and then every 2 years in that decade between 40 and 50, and then yearly after the age 50. And, you know, mammography is controversial, and I always feel like I have to have a long discussion with my patients. It's, you know, there's both good and bad things about it. I think that there's some recent research that shows that it's overvalued. A lot of the lesions that are found on mammography are what are called ductal carcinoma in situ, which is cancer, but it's not really cancer in the sense that it hasn't invaded. It's really just in the ducts. It would be the same thing if you had a skin cancer on your skin. And some of those progress on to cancer and some of them don't. The other controversy is when they look at the increased survival time of mammography, there's usually a year delay from when a mammogram will find a lesion usually a year earlier than self-breast exam. But then when they look at the outcomes, they don't add that year on. And so they're saying that the people that have mammography are living a year longer, but not really living a year longer because they're forgetting to count that there was a whole year that the women that didn't have mammography lived before their cancer was discovered. Does that make sense?
Clarify a little more. That's tricky.
Well, so usually they describe the survival time from the point of diagnosis to when a woman dies. But mammography will find a cancer perhaps a year earlier. And when they're looking at comparing those to women that just find cancer by self-breast exam, they're not including that first, that other whole year that they lived with their cancer unknown. And it's usually about a year difference between the two.
So in essence, the mammography will give them advance warning, and that gets counted in survival time, whereas the person who didn't get mammography had that same year, but it wasn't diagnosed.
But it isn't counted as part of their survival
right.
time, even though they lived that year.
Yeah.
So, you know, I think it's a hard thing. I mean, I won't dispute that mammography finds cancer earlier, but the questions I have about it is, you know, is it necessarily beneficial? I think in some cases it is, in some cases it isn't. And it also, I think, leads to what I call the slippery slope, is that they see some calcifications, you get a biopsy, you get this diagnosis of ductal carcinoma in situ, which sometimes goes on to cancer and sometimes don't, and maybe it leads to a lot of stress and worry that didn't need to be there.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So I, you know, personally, I definitely think the other thing that's happened with mammography is that women and some even physicians are really discounting the self-breast exam and are just saying, just do the mammogram every year, and not do the self-breast exam, and I think that's a huge mistake, as well as not doing a thorough clinical breast exam. And there's really good research that when done properly, and this is the issue, is a lot of physicians, I don't think, do it very thoroughly, that can be an excellent detection tool.
Okay, let's talk about that, the manual breast exam, the really good one. What's different from that about what people might have already experienced from a manual exam, or what they do themselves?
Well, and first thing I want to say is that I think for what you do yourself, I'm not particular about the methodology. I mean, I think the most important thing is that you do the breast exam and you know what feels normal to you. The analogy I use to my patients is, you know, God knows I'm not a car mechanic, but I drive my car every day, and if I feel a pink or bong, I know to take it in. And that's really the goal of self-breast exam, is for you to get really comfortable with your own tissue and know what's normal for you. And then if you feel something abnormal, to seek some care. And I think a lot of women don't do self-breast exam, first of all, because it's kind of weird to look for cancer. I think that's can be kind of energetically weird and kind of scary for some women. And it's just, you know, too weird of a thing. I like to really reframe it as sort of self-breast care, and that it's more of a nurturing thing, and just really getting comfortable and knowing your own tissue. For providers, you know, the thorough exam should take anywhere between 3 to 5 minutes per breast. So that's, I think that's a good indicator of how thorough the exam is. The research has shown that the provider should palpate or examine the tissue at 3 levels. So it should be, you know, superficial and medium and deep. And in fact, if you have tender breasts, the breast exam actually should be tender. And I apologize to my patients, and I, you know, my intention is not to hurt them, but I want to do a thorough exam, and they really should be doing all of those levels. And generally, for an average-sized breast woman, the practitioner should be doing about 12 stripes up and down when they're doing the examination.
Okay, I hope that clears it up. Now, I do want to remind our listeners that we're going to accept calls on this segment. Dr. Heidi Peterson is here to answer your questions, as well as to chat up women's health in general with me, and you can reach us at 231-8187 or 231-8087. 3-2. So either way is fine, and I'll work with the calls. Heidi, there's another thing that's in the news that doesn't get enough attention, I think, when women go for their annual reproductive health care examination, and that is human papilloma virus, HPV.
Correct.
It's not considered routine in most exams, and yet a lot of people think that it should be, and because it's not routine, women are being encouraged to request it. So why don't you talk about HPV?
Well, HPV is a virus that causes genital warts, and genital warts in and of themselves are not a huge problem. The problem is it's the virus that also causes cervical cancer, vaginal cancer, and vulvar cancer. And the Pap screen is a test that's used to screen for that. And when they're doing the Pap exam, you're scraping a few cells off the cervix, and a pathologist is looking for changes in the cells. Newer technology, what they call the thin prep Pap, which is where they take the cells and they put them in solution rather than putting them on the slide, allows the laboratory to actually detect whether you have the virus in your cells. And the nice thing about that is that there's many different strains of the virus, but there's about 4 strains that are considered to be high risk. And if you have the high risk strain, then you know to be more watchful for cancer. And the Pap smear, you know, isn't, although it's effective, it's not 100% in diagnosing cancer. So I think it's really useful for women to know if they have the virus or not. And that's an easy option that you, in most practitioners, can just tick off on the lab slip when women are having their annual exam.
Okay, that helps. Now, we have some callers. So, first caller, go ahead. What's your question, dear? Hello.
Hello.
Hello, caller. Go ahead.
I have been involved with breast cancer research for many years, and I think that we're talking about mammograms irradiating the tender tissue of the breast that is so susceptible to the DNA damage caused by radiation. This doesn't really make sense to me. And I am aware, and I would like your comments on thermography as an alternative to annual mammograms.
Well, that's a great question. And the radiation issue is always a hard one in cancer. I think both in the screening and treatment, you know, here we are using a thing that we know to cause cancer, to screen for cancer and treat for it, and it's always a little bit hard to wrap your head around that. One thing I will say is that the newer mammograms, the digital ones, do have less radiation. And actually, some of my concern with mammograms, doesn't relate just to the radiation, but also to the actual physical compression of the breast. There is some research out there that suggests physical trauma to the breast is actually a cause of breast cancer. So I know several patients that had severe motor vehicle accidents that, where the seatbelt gave them a big bruise on their breast. And then 20, 30 years later, that's actually where their breast cancer developed. So I think that is, that's a separate concern that a lot of people don't discuss. I think thermography is a great option. I think one thing that you have to understand about thermography is it's not the same thing as mammography, nor is it the same thing as ultrasound. They're using different types of radiation to evaluate the breast, and it gives you different types of information. So the ultrasound is going to tell you whether something is a solid or a mass. So if you have a cyst, you can easily do an ultrasound and see it's all fluid and you know that it's not a solid mass. The mammography is really an X-ray, and what X-ray really looks for is calcification or calcium deposits. And they're a little bit tricky to read because calcium deposits occur normally throughout tissue as you age, and what they're looking for in the mammogram is whether there's high density of calcium, and that's suggestive of cancer. Thermography is really looking at heat. So what happens in thermography in a thermogram is a woman goes into a room that's about 70 degrees, and she just stands there with her top off, and they're picking up the heat or the radiation that's put out by the breast. And the idea behind thermography is that cancer tends to be hot. Cancer is a pig, is what I call it, and they a metabolic pig, and they take up a lot of energy and tends to put out more heat. By the way, thermography is not just for the breasts. It's actually a system that can be used for the whole body and is sometimes used when you can't figure out what's going on with someone. You're kind of looking for the hot spot in their body. And I think thermography is an excellent option. I think there's several challenges with it. Number one, it's very expensive, and not many insurances are covering it. I know a couple of them are covering it now. And to get the best results for it, you need to have a baseline and then have a repeat one versus within that the 3 to 6 month period. And I think it gives great information, but I think it just gives different information. The other problem with it is we don't have the experience with it and interpreting it with that we do with mammography. We have a lot of years and a lot of physicians that are trained to read mammography that we don't have thermography. But I think it's an excellent option, and I wish it was available and covered for more women.
Okay, Heidi, we have another caller. Caller, go ahead. Hello, caller.
Hello.
Yeah, go ahead.
Hello, I'd like to know if the doctor would like to address any relationship she might feel between underarm deodorant and breast cancer.
The whole aluminum story. I mean, it's definitely out there. The research, there just isn't great research on it. I think philosophically, from a naturopathic point of view, I don't think you ever want to stop up a discharge. When I was in school, we had a professor that said, rejoice in the discharge. And, you know, in your body, whenever you're, you know, have sweating or diarrhea or you have snot coming out of your nose, all of that is your body trying to clear some, you know, detox in some sort of way. And I think blocking that up is not, any of those things are not good for overall health. But I think the research is a little equivocal on that, but I certainly don't recommend it, and I don't think it's healthy just philosophically.
And in line with that question, what about the underwire bra?
Again, the same situation. The research on it is not very clear, but when you look at breast tissue, it's mainly what we call lymphatic tissue, and certainly the underwire bras inhibit the flow of lymphatics, and I think it is a way to sort of congest breast tissue. And that's certainly a concern, you know, that I have, particularly with women that have a lot of breast pain. I feel that is a really congestive issue and that they need to get more lymphatic circulation in that area. But, you know, unfortunately, the researchers aren't really interested in this issue, and I would be wrong to say there's a ton of research that supports that. But philosophically, I think that is there. On the other hand, I have to be empathetic to large-breasted women that it is hard for them sometimes to feel comfortable and get the support that they need without an underwire. And I think it's a hard situation if you have large breasts.
Well, the bra companies are coming around.
Yep.
And the bras are changing. There are cotton bras now that are double width. They're very comfortable.
Right.
They work for women who have larger breasts, and you can find them. You just need to shop around a bit.
Right. No, I'm right with you.
Yeah. Heidi, we have another caller. Caller, go ahead.
Yes, I wanted to mention the importance of vitamin D3 intake. That's D as in dog, and specifically the D3 is supposed to cut the risk of breast cancer by 50%. That's what I've heard anyway.
Well, you just fed into my favorite topic. I've been very excited about the recent vitamin D3 research. And in fact, probably in the last 2 or 3 years, I've been testing most of the women in my practice for vitamin D. And it's astounding how many women are low or suboptimal. And it's probably been the biggest change in my practice in the last 3 years. And it has a huge effect on breast cancer, colon cancer, prostate cancer for the guys, as well as a bunch of other health issues. For women, I think it has a huge impact, obviously, in bone health. I don't know if you heard in the news recently, there was a Women's Health Initiative a couple months ago came out and said, oh, you don't really need to take calcium. The research in this big trial, the calcium didn't really help with bones. And I think the reason it didn't show, well, first is they were using crappy calcium, but also my suspicion is that most of those women are low in vitamin D. It's interesting, the RDA for vitamin D is either 400 international units or 800 if you're an older person. But if you look at what humans got at the equator running around in the loincloth, they got somewhere between 8,000 to 10,000 IU. So that's quite a bit different. And I've just seen fantastic results with depression, diabetes, bone health, with vitamin D in my practice. And it's one test that I, pretty much living in this area, I think almost everybody should have.
So here comes the question, where do we get it?
Well, you can ask your physician to order it. There's an interesting revolution taking place in medicine now that you can order online. If you're willing to pay cash, you can order online virtually any health test that you want. There's many different labs that you just go online and you input the test that you want and give them a credit card number, and they send you to a local lab and they send the results directly to you, which a lot of physicians don't like, but I actually think it's a good revolution in that it really, if people have concerns and their doctor isn't willing to help them, they can at least get the information themselves. I certainly recommend if you have a low value and you're going to pursue therapy that you follow it up with a physician. One of the things about vitamin D is it is a fat-soluble vitamin, and it actually is a hormone. It actually works like estrogen and progesterone, and although I think I get great results, you have to be careful not to overdose.
So where do you find sources of this vitamin D3?
Well, sunlight is the best, and we seem to be lacking in that here.
So would that be like cod liver oil, for example?
Well, cod liver oil is another food source, although with some of the patients that I've worked with that have extremely low levels, they need to actually, unfortunately, take a supplement. Cod liver oil is great, and I love cod liver oil, and if you are taking a generous amount of that, you're probably getting about 1,000 IUs of vitamin D a day. But some of the people that my patients I've treated have needed up to 4,000, 6,000, or even 8,000 IUs to get them in the normal range. And that's something you wouldn't want to do at all without supervision.
Right. Oh, this is exciting. So I'm grateful that we had a male caller, and I want to invite more men. I want to remind our listeners, you are Dr. Heidi Peterson. You're a naturopathic physician. You're here talking about health in general, women's health in particular, especially reproductive health, but that's not the only thing that you're able to do. You do all sorts of health care across the board. And if people are interested in connecting with you, you are listed in the book as Dr. Heidi Peterson. But if they have health questions, this is just an information show. It's not meant for you to treat yourselves. Another question that comes up in my mind, because we're talking about some of the things that go wrong, and, for example, with breast cancer, what is the healthy lifestyle for healthy breast tissue, for example? What is a healthy diet? What are healthy things to do besides avoiding antiperspirants and underwire bras?
Well, certainly there's a lot of healthy things to do. Number one, drink less alcohol. About 2 drinks a week is considered. If you go above that, you're at higher risk for breast cancer. Certainly eating things from the brassicacea family, so that's Brussels sprouts, cabbage, cauliflower, broccoli. I think that I listed most of them. Those have a compound in it called indole-3-carbinol, which helps you metabolize estrogen appropriately. I think the biggest issue is to avoid pesticides and other compounds, which are called xenoestrogens. These are chemicals in the environment that act like estrogen on the breast, and I think that they're the biggest implication in breast cancer. I think it's really sad that the money's out there is the race for the pure, not the race for the cause. And I feel like breast cancer and many other hormone issues in women is due to the endocrine system sensitivity to the toxicity in our world. And I sort of joke that we're the canaries, which is sad.
Yeah, it is very sad. In keeping with the discussion about healthy eating, one of the things that I'm very suspicious of is when people eat cheese, which is a casein product, and which I now know from Howard Lyman, casein can be something that fuels the growth of tumors.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you're into that sphere, but is that your understanding?
I actually haven't, you know.
So the dairy product thing is kind of marginal on some level?
Well, I don't know. The biggest issue for me with dairy products is whether they're organic or not. And when you look at, you know, if you have a limited budget and you have to make choices about what you're going to eat organic, I mean, obviously, I think everybody would love to eat everything organic, but that financially isn't always possible. But probably the worst things are the things that have the most pesticides in them are dairy products. In fact, the most toxic substance out there is butter. So if you're going to buy one thing that organic, buy organic butter.
Butter.
Because it's fat, and fat is where all of these xenoestrogens tend to accumulate. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, dairy and cheese, of course, also has a lot of fat in it, and it collects there. I'm actually not familiar with the casein issue, but I certainly could see it. I think that's a complicated question.
Okay, the other part of that question then is the plastic wrap that is used in so many dairy products, especially cheeses, are wrapped in plastic. And one of the things people should look at is the surface of the cheese when you pull off the plastic wrap. And if it looks like it's glossy and it has indents from the cheese, you should probably peel all that off, because all you're doing is ingesting petrochemicals. Is that correct?
I mean, plastics are a huge source of xenoestrogen.
Thank you.
And you want to avoid them as much as possible. I mean, I think if you have the opportunity, if you're going to drink milk, to buy milk in the glass bottles, it's better for you. It's better for the environment. The biggest thing with plastics, if you have to use plastics, please don't microwave in them. The heating actually activates the release of the chemicals. So, but it would be better, you know, I mean, I think better. It would be better if we went back to the cheeses wrapped in wax paper that you bought at the cheese counter.
I'm very concerned about the microwaving of foods. I see that all over workplaces, women with their little plastic containers popping them in the microwave. And every time I see one, I think, oh, my God, that's, you know, you're putting yourself at risk for all sorts of things, including breast cancer, because we know that those plastics can be vaporized under conditions of heat, especially with creamy hot liquids in them.
Correct. So that, you know, that's a concern. I try to encourage people to move towards at least the glass containers.
And we've known that, I think, since the late 70s when the Italian researchers first found out. And it's you're right. The race for the cure isn't the issue. It's the cause of the cure.
Another concern with those plastics is also baby bottles.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Because a lot of people...
heating them up in kettles.
Right.
And feeding your baby polyvinyls.
Right.
Oh, God. Here's a caller who wants to say something. Caller, go ahead.
Yes, I just wanted to mention that a source that I'd found that was affordable and high quality for vitamin D3 was Vitacost.com. And they had a 1,000-unit capsule. And I think 200 capsules was under $6. And... I'm not sure of the dose. Dr. Bailey was saying anywhere from 2 to 4 capsules a day was what he would recommend. So that's the one thing I'm unsure of. And as far as xenoestrogens go, have you also addressed the tofu issue or the soy product issue?
Sure. So just one comment on the vitamin D. The vitamin D, in my experience, is really cheap no matter where you get it. I mean, that's actually one of the fun things is it has a huge health impact, and it's nothing that people have to spend millions of dollars on. The dose is, in my opinion, is anywhere between 2,000 and 8,000, but you do need to be aware as you get in those higher doses, it can potentially be toxic. And I really wouldn't recommend going to those higher doses without working with someone and having testing and follow-up.
Which means see your private provider.
Right, right. The soy issue is huge, and I have to say I'm not a fan of soy. You know, I think what happened with soy, this is such a typical American story, is there was a research about, coming out of Asia that women had less breast cancer and they ate more soy. And we thought, okay, a little soy is good, so let's have a lot of soy because that's what we do when we're Americans. And we kind of went soy crazy. And I have concerns about soy. I don't, you know, certainly in my practice, sort of unrelated to breast cancer, I see about a third of Caucasians that actually have soy allergies. And I've seen several patients that said, oh, I'm eating a healthier diet, and I started eating more soy in the last years, and I'm feeling worse and worse. And it turned out that they had a soy allergy. And there's definitely some research, you know, certainly with younger girls, I have concern about soy formula and their risk with breast cancer. And at this point, I'm not recommending super high-dose soy supplements to my patients. I certainly think that soy is a great food, and in fact, that was how it was meant to be. So enjoy your soy milk, enjoy your tofu, enjoy your soy nuts, but I don't think we should be going soy crazy, and particularly in its more concentrated form, so the soy protein powder or the soy isolated supplements.
And they haven't really figured out how to make good soy yogurt, let's face it. There are a couple attempts, but boy, it's just all the way down the line. It's Nancy's for me. The issue of mad cow and the question I raised about the casein and dairy products, mm-hmm. but let's get back to mad cow because Howard Lyman was in town a few weeks ago and talked about the importance of a vegan diet. And the third diagnosed mad cow in this country was, in Alabama not too long ago. And the USDA, which was testing less than 1%, is now agreed to test even less than that now that they found three dead carcasses in this country. What are your thoughts about eating beef?
Well, I actually have a slightly different thought. I actually joke with people I'm a recovering vegetarian. I used to be a vegetarian, and I think that being a vegetarian is good for some people, but we're all biochemically individuals, and I think that there are some people that actually do well eating meat. And if you look at traditional cultures, which I really like to get my wisdom from that, a lot of traditional cultures eat meat. I think the issue with meat is animal husbandry. We never had any business feeding cows other cow parts, and I think if we had proper animal husbandry and really treated and cared for animals in the way that they were meant to be, a lot of these issues with eating meat wouldn't be there. I mean, the classic example is beef. If beef is 100% grass-fed and grazed like cows were meant to be, then they actually have more omega-3 fatty acids than fish. So, you know, we're all told to eat more and more salmon to get, and other fishes to get omega-3 fatty acids, but we actually could get that from beef if the cows were produced in a proper way. And there are a few sources that you can get beef in that way. I think there's a few farms in Oregon and places that you can get it down at the farmer's market. So, I think that philosophically I love the idea of being a vegan. I think there's a lot of good ideas behind that. But in working with people with, specific health issues, there really are people that do better on a higher protein diet.
Thanks. I appreciate the varying points of view that we are able to provide on this program because people can get stuck in one pocket or another, and I think you bring a nice general wisdom. And again, this is Dr. Heidi Peterson, naturopathic physician. We're taking calls 231-8187 or 231-8032. Heidi's here for the next little less than a half hour to answer your questions. Heidi, one of the things that people talk about is, I'd like to go to a naturopath, but gee whiz, when you go, they test your saliva and they can't fix something fast. And I just don't get it. And I don't know. I think I'm just going to stay with my MD. Help these people understand.
Well, I think you have to understand that, what we're doing is a little bit different. We really believe in sort of a multifactorial cause of disease, and we're really trying to treat people holistically and shift their whole biochemistry. And it's just not the same thing as, going to your doctor and saying, I'm depressed and I want Prozac. So a patient recently consulted me about depression and was like, well, should I just take St. John's wort? And to me, that's not at all what natural medicine is about. It's not that you take this herb instead of that drug. It's really about looking for the underlying cause. And usually the underlying cause is more than one thing. We're really complex beings. And it usually takes a journey to get there, and you have to be ready to take that journey and really evaluate a lot of different systems. And you will get there in the long run, but sometimes it takes a long time. I mean, I think one of my favorite patients who had diabetes and was doing everything right and doing the right diet and wasn't controlled, it took us 3 years of trying out different testing and assessing different problems before we found the true underlying cause. And once that was fixed, he's eating. He can even cheat a lot and be well controlled, but it's not the quick fix.
Heidi?
Yes.
I'm sorry, I was picking up some calls. Let's go ahead. We got a Jillian. Go ahead, caller.
Hi.
Caller, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Okay. Hi. I came in a little bit late. I'm listening to your speaker. And hello?
Caller, just go ahead. Ask your question.
Oh, okay.
Okay, we're going to lose that caller. Caller, I'm sorry, we're gonna not be able to take this call. So we'll try this one. Caller, go ahead.
Hi, I'm calling about eczema, and I missed the section on the casein that you guys had talked about earlier, but I heard that you'd mentioned that. And my question is, my wife has been tested as allergic to casein, and then almonds came up pretty high as well. She's been to naturopaths and traditional homeopaths to deal with the eczema, but nothing has worked. So I'm wondering if you have any exciting insights.
Well, I think eczema is a hard condition to treat. And first of all, I joke that food allergy testing is the holy grail of natural medicine. And there's many different tests, and figuring out food allergies can be amazing, but sometimes they're not easy to figure out. And you know what? Sometimes they're not the cause. I think from our point of view, the skin is a reflection of digestive health. And sometimes eczema is related to other gut issues besides food allergies. So, for instance, some people have a fungal infection, a chronic fungal infection in their gut, and some other issues. Sometimes it's related to not getting enough essential fatty acids. So, you know, I think some of my colleagues and some people in the natural health world can get really stuck and simplify health and say, eczema is always food allergies, and it's not always food allergies, and there might be other issues there, and trying to figure out what the underlying issue is.
Okay, Heidi, we have another caller. Before we do that, people are asking how to contact you, especially the spelling of your name, Dr. Peterson, so that they can hook up with you. Do you want to offer that information?
So the last name is Peterson.
Okay. We have another caller. Caller, go ahead. Okay, we lost that caller, too. One of the things I need to say, we've lost two callers here, and I'll tell you what's happening. I have people calling in on cell phones. And cell phones, especially if you're driving in a car, they cut in and out. And you've got your radio on and you're listening and you're cutting out when I'm trying to pick up the call. So what I recommended to my last caller was to pull over by the side of the road and turn the radio down and just hold on. Let's see. Are you there?
Yes, I'm here. Okay. Do you hear me?
Okay, we got one. Go ahead.
Okay.
Yeah, go ahead.
Here I go, pulling over right now. Okay. So for the past few years, hello?
Yes.
Just keep going.
Thank you. I started to have some female health problems, and I feel like it's been kind of like a positive feedback system. It's just gotten worse and worse once one thing has happened. And I was diagnosed with pelvic inflammatory disease a couple years ago. And then from there, I've just had chronic yeast infections, chronic infections of all kinds. And now I recently just had I found a cyst in my breast. And I was just curious, like, I haven't been able to find any kind of real explanation for, like, I mean, I was wondering what are commonly the foundations of these kinds of problems?
Well, I think, you know, starting with you had a lot of chronic infections, and you have to sort of look at why you're having chronic infections. You know, the PID is a little bit trickier. I mean, often that's can be sexually transmitted, but not always. The chronic vaginitis, I think you have to look at the vagina as an ecosystem. And, you know, particularly if you've had just ongoing antibiotic therapy, they aren't really addressing the sort of the ecosystem. And you have to sort of think of it as sort of like the rainforest that's going to rise, and you need to come back and bring things into balance. The cysts in the breast, you know, may or may not be related to that. Sometimes that's related to hormone imbalance. Sometimes that is related to sort of lymphatic issues. But you know, it sounds like your whole system is out of balance, and you need to do some work to figure out what that underlying imbalance is. But it's, you know, I think it's hard to know exactly what that is. But there's definitely, obviously, something that's not working for you, and you need to look for the underlying cause.
Yeah, Heidi, I think that raises a really interesting issue for a lot of young women who are coming of age sexually at this time in history. And this is it's a stressful time out there in the sexual marketplace. It's really important for women to use protection, mm-hmm. to protect themselves. And what kinds of protection do you think are really helpful to women Because sometimes when women are taking birth control pills, that also alters their flora, and that can contribute to problems, right?
I mean, I think the safest thing out there is to use condoms, and in the sense that they do provide the best protection against sexually transmitted infections. And one of the issues with the birth control pill is that when women take them, they are more susceptible to getting vaginal infections, particularly right. yeast infections, and then that actually makes them more susceptible to getting other infections because the immune system is brought down. One of the things that's very concerning to me is a lot of the spermicides. The research out there shows that it actually makes more women more susceptible to getting HIV. So, you know, the spermicide, you know, I think most young women are concerned about not getting pregnant, which is certainly a valid concern, but right. I think the sexually transmitted infections actually should be a bigger concern.
Now, when you say condoms, are you talking about femicoms or male condoms or the combination?
Either one.
Okay, now, what I recall about contraception barrier methods, which is what we're talking about, and efficacy in terms of pregnancy, a condom by itself is in the high 80s in
Correct.
Terms of percent. A condom on a male with female protection, such as a diaphragm or a cervical cap or, let's see, what else would there be, a femicom, then you bring it up into the higher percentages in the 90s where you start approximating the pill, which is about 98%, right?
Correct. And so, you know,
so you need two barrier methods to really prevent pregnancy.
I mean, I think the other issue that comes with the barrier methods, which is hard when you look at the data, is they have perfect use versus sort of standard use. And some of the issues that I see with people is, you know, when they have at least contraception failures, that they've actually just failed to use the device.
Okay.
And so I think people really need to be committed to using them every time and following the rules when using them. Mm-hmm. But certainly using a couple different methods, you know, gives you the best protection. I think
right.
the barrier methods probably aren't the best, aren't the optimal methods for protecting against pregnancy, but they're much better protecting against infections. And it's hard, you know, contraception is hard, and I always have people calling and asking me for herbal contraception or herbal abortions, abortifacients, and I just don't believe in them. Nature naturally wants you to get pregnant. Contraception is actually right. not a natural thing. And unfortunately, I think you're really looking, when you're choosing contraceptives, you're looking at which drawback do you tolerate the best rather than which one is optimal, because
right.
none of them are.
Well, and I think also for women who are making these decisions at this time in their lives, get to know your cycle and kind of have a sense of when you're ovulating. You should know there's a 7 to 10 day period when you're optimally going to get pregnant, and that's when you really want to be very careful about the method of contraception, right?
Right, but it can happen anytime.
It can happen anytime, right, but there's a peak period, and that's
right.
when you really want to make sure you're protected and that you're not just off the cuff.
And I think that every woman should get to know their cycle. There's a fabulous book out of there called Take Charge of Your Fertility.
Say it slowly again and give us an author.
Take Charge of Your Fertility by Toni Wexler. Mm-hmm. And it's a book that's both intended for natural family planning and also for optimizing getting pregnant. And I think it's an excellent book if you want to sort of learn more about your cycle, how you change, how your mucus changes. I love the book. One thing on the side, though, a lot of people come to me to be educated about natural family planning, which I think is an excellent option, although as a woman I have a little bit of difficulty with it because many women in that time when they're most fertile is when they want to have sex the most. And so it's a little bit hard. In the traditional methods, they sort of say to abstain in that period, and I think that is not always best for the woman.
I think there's something else that needs to be said about this whole topic also, and that is I guess it was the 60s was when we had that little window of time when we had antibiotics and we had birth control pills, so women didn't have to get pregnant and they didn't have to get syphilis or gonorrhea and get, you know, die of it or have latent Louis tertiary syphilis or any of those things. We could manage that. And then it sort of opened up the door and made women think they could always be eternally available to men. Let's just put that right out there on the table. And the reality is that's not true, because after that period ended, we got other things. We got viruses that came down the pike, and they were much more difficult to manage and created lots more problems. And so finally women started coming to the conclusion that availability really wasn't their trump card. And I think that's kind of where we have to be as women. You have to begin to recognize that you have to kind of put yourself up on a pedestal. And Heidi, I'm sort of out here on the edge of the board. So if you want to jump in, just jump right in. But I think we have to sort of honor this reproductive function of ours and make very careful choices about our sexual activity, because there are ways in which people can actually damage themselves just by thinking they have a right to the same kinds of things that men might be able to do that really aren't appropriate for women.
Well, I think women just need to be in charge of their bodies, and I certainly...
Better said.
You know, and I certainly want women to be more educated. Certainly, when I do my annual exams, I offer women the opportunity to use a mirror, and I'm always surprised at how many women don't even know their own anatomy. And I think that's a really important starting point, to just even sort of know the equipment that you have and to know that it's yours and yours to take care of, and that you have the right to say no and make choices. And, you know, the other thing I always like to remind women when we're discussing contraception and issues, there's other ways to be intimate than just to have sexual intercourse.
Right. Well said. Another issue that's really out there all the time and keeps coming up and going down is hormone replacement therapy. Where are we in terms of the status of that process right now? And tell people what that is.
Well, and I'm really glad you asked the question, because there's actually some interesting news about that. Hormones, initially women were given hormone replacement, and it was Premarin, which came hormones from a pregnant cow's urine, which is always interesting to contemplate. And they relieved a lot of menopausal symptoms. And actually, 15 years ago, the standard medical community kind of considered them the panacea, and women were put on them, the minute they were menopausal. In fact, there was one physician that sort of wanted women to be on oral contraceptives from the moment they menstruated, and then on hormone replacement till they died, and then they sort of considered women unsafe if their hormones weren't controlled.
That's a lot of monthly visits, isn't it?
It's a lot of hormones. And then the research came out with a correlation between hormones and breast cancer, as well as some concerns about heart disease. And, you know, Premarin sort of came off the market, but then women were going through menopause and still having a lot of symptoms. And then the sort of natural health community sort of came out with the option of something called, well, what people often like to call natural hormones, but it's actually really a misnomer. The correct term is bioidentical hormones. And sort of with the idea is that if you're going to take hormones, safer options are to take the very same ones that you have in your body versus horse estrogen. Take some human estrogen and take them in much smaller physiological doses. I mean, one of the things that astounds me about almost all of the research that's done on women on hormones is that they actually never test levels, that they gave every woman horse estrogen and the same amount. And then, you know, and if you look in medicine, any other type of hormone, they would always test for levels first before giving them to women. And so I do wonder if some of the issues were women were getting overdosed, and then the other issue is that they were getting a hormone that wasn't, their body didn't know what to do. I used to be a chemist, and biochemically, you know, we've evolved over these years, and we have certain pathways to metabolize hormones that are in us, and our body actually knows what to do with them. And I think it's a hard call. I think it's most healthy and most optimal for women to go through menopause and not use hormones. But the reality is a lot of women are out there suffering. And I think if that's a goal in your life, not to use hormones in menopause, you need to start doing your work in your 30s and 40s. I actually joke that PMS is the trailer for menopause, and if you're having a lot of PMS symptoms, that means your body is having a hard time with hormones, and you better start working now rather than, you know, 10 or 20 years down the road. And what I see with a lot of women in my practice is that they're suffering, and there's a lot of good natural work that they can do, but, you know, we're behind the eight ball, and they need some relief now. And I do think that natural and bioidentical hormones are a nice option when, you know, used appropriately and safely, and hopefully for the shortest amount of time. And I try to prescribe them for women to buy us time to do the foundational work, but I don't want them to suffer. One thing that's, I don't know if you know in the news about natural or bioidentical hormones that's out there, is Wyeth, which is a big pharmaceutical company who used to sell Premarin and has lost millions and billions of dollars because no women are taking their hormones anymore, actually are trying to sue so that the bioidentical hormones cannot be made anymore by compounding pharmacies.
And the beat goes on. Heidi, I have one last question. One of the things that shows up when people have a chem study done, just the overall, they're always looking at their cholesterol and their good cholesterol, their HDL. But there's a little thing called triglycerides. In my understanding, these come from hydrogenated carbons, which are no-nos, right?
I I wouldn't say it that way. I do. I'm glad you brought up the cholesterol question because I feel like as a country we're a little bit over fixated on cholesterol.
Okay, go ahead.
And when you look at heart disease, cholesterol is one of maybe 7 different biochemical markers. And when people come in with high cholesterol, I say, well, look, before you get all excited, we really need to look at the whole picture. I think that the biggest issue with triglycerides, which to me are more concerning than high cholesterol. So when I see a patient that have high triglycerides, I'm more concerned. I think that's really related to too much sugar and poor insulin control. And certainly, your question, I don't know the exact answer to.
Well, is there a normal range for triglycerides, or should there be a very low range?
Well, the normal range for most labs is under 150. I think for optimal health, you should be under 100 or around 100. And to me, when you have high triglycerides, is you're getting too much sugar in your diet and you're not having good blood sugar control, and it's a early warning sign for diabetes. And I think that clogs up your arteries as much or worse than the cholesterol. The other issues with heart disease is really around inflammation.
Oh, keep going. When you see me moving around, just keep talking.
So there's a new test called C-reactive protein, which is a marker of inflammation in the vessels, and there's a lot of new research suggesting that inflammation is as big risk factor for cholesterol for heart disease as is cholesterol.
It's interesting. You mentioned that triglycerides can clog up arterioles as much as cholesterol. I remember hearing that 30 and 40 years ago, and then that sort of fell out of fashion. But I remember working in intensive care and coronary care and hearing the cardiac surgeons talk that way.
Yeah, I don't know why it fell out
of fashion. And then it sort of disappeared.
I don't know why it fell out of fashion, because it's actually just basic biochemistry.
Yeah.
For people to understand the difference between the two, cholesterol is like butter, triglycerides is like olive oil. They're both fats. They're just in biochemically slightly different. But the triglycerides are just as important as the cholesterol. And any biochemist will tell you if you have too much sugar, the body is going to turn it into triglycerides. Fat is a storage form for sugar. So I always feel like the snack wall cookies are the biggest joke out there, because they're these supposedly diet cookies that are full of sugar but have no fat. But if you get enough sugar, your body's just going to make fat.
Blah, blah, blah. Heidi, one last quickie beyond the triglyceride question then. What is the problem with partially or fully hydrogenated oils?
Well, it's that the body doesn't know, again, what to do with them. When they're hydrogenated, they become what's called trans fat, which has to do with the orientations of the fats in space, and those are very carcinogenic and also tend to promote plaques in the vessels. So, you know, I think it always comes back. We were never meant to eat margarine.
Yeah.
And if we just stuck to food that was natural and didn't go in the lab and try to create food, we'd always be better off.
Going in the lab creating food, my. One last caller, Heidi. Caller, go ahead.
Hi. Good afternoon. How are you? Okay, I'm going to make this really quick. The correlation between the politics and economy of breast cancer, and how it's really not profitable to find a cure or a cause, because the big pharmaceutical companies, the oncologists, the hospitals, yada, 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 will not be making any money off a wonderful cottage industry. Have a very nice afternoon.
Well, I think the politics are very complicated, and you know, I think it even goes further than that. It also goes to the politics of agriculture and fertilizers and petrochemicals. And, you know, people aren't willing to make the recognition that these chemicals are a big cause of cancer. And there is sort of the whole cancer industry. And I work with a lot of, you know, oncologists and breast cancer doctors, and they are really good people, and they have the interest in their patients' heart. I think it's sort of a shift as a whole society that we have to make, and it's very complex, but there's certainly a huge amount of politics in that world.
Well, Heidi, this has been a wonderful, wonderful hour. What a gift. Dr. Heidi Peterson, naturopathic physician. Heidi, you want to tell people if they want to reach you how they can do that?
Probably the best way to reach me is they can via email, and that's on my website, which is doctorheidi.com. So it's drheidi.com. And there's an email link there.
Oh, that's cool. And you will be having a baby in the near term, so that you're not going to be available right away.
Correct.
Okay. Heidi, is there anything you want to say that we haven't already talked about that you think is important?
Well, there's just one other issue to women's health that I like to put out there, because it's so simple and I hate for it to be missed. There's some newer research that a lot of women are actually anemic, but it's not being detected on the standard test for anemia is something called a complete blood count, where they just look at how many red blood cells you have. But the latest research for women is that that can be normal, but they can be low in iron with a test that's called ferritin that tests their iron stores. And if their ferritins aren't in the optimal level, they can have fatigue and every symptom of anemia. But a lot of doctors are missing it, and it's a diagnosis that I love to pick up, because how easy is it to get some more iron in your diet and bring that up?
Eat some spinach.
So if there's women out there that are having a lot of fatigue and they haven't had this ferritin test, they might want to ask their physician for it. And the standard normals for that are something like 10 to 200. It's a joke. I like to see most women to have be between 50 and 100. And that's probably another thing besides vitamin D that's really been big in my practice the last couple of years.
We have to eat more dark greens, period. Yeah, with a little bit of vinegar or lemon, like Grandma used to do.
Definitely.
Hey, Heidi, it's been a wonderful hour. Heidi Peterson, naturopathic physician. Best to you, darling. Thank you so much for being here, and can't wait to see the new baby.
All right, thank you for having me.
My pleasure, Heidi.